Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we explore a phase 3 trial of finerenone in type 1 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, and guidance on timing of non-culprit lesion PCI after STEMI. We cover an investigational therapy for Dravet syndrome and neoadjuvant treatment for high-risk intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. We review the effects of radiotherapy on normal tissue, a puzzling case of progressive neurologic decline after suspected foodborne illness, and perspectives on private equity, the AHEAD model, and medical credit cards. A new Clinical Decisions discusses blood pressure targets in hypertension management. A 75-year-old man with hypertension comes to your primary care practice for a routine follow-up appointment. After your evaluation, you must decide whether to intensify the antihypertensive therapy to target a systolic blood pressure of less than 120 millimeters mercury, or to maintain the current therapy with a systolic blood pressure target of less than 140 millimeters mercury. What would you choose? Visit NEJM.org to vote. Finerenone in type 1 diabetes and chronic kidney disease by Hido Heerspink from the University Medical Center Groningen, the Netherlands, and co-authors. Type 1 diabetes affects approximately 9.5 million persons worldwide, and the prevalence is projected to rise. Chronic kidney disease, CKD, remains a common microvascular complication of type 1 diabetes, despite many advances in diabetes care. The non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, finerenone, has been reported to improve kidney and cardiovascular outcomes in persons with type 2 diabetes and CKD. Now, this phase 3 trial evaluated the efficacy and safety of finerenone in persons with type 1 diabetes and CKD. 242 participants were randomly assigned to receive finerenone or matching placebo. Over a period of 6 months, finerenone resulted in a significantly greater decrease in the primary outcome of the urinary albumin to creatinine ratio than placebo. The most common adverse event was hyperkalemia in 10.1% of participants with finerenone and 3.3% with placebo. Alexandra Kukla and Marie Hogan from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota, write in an editorial that patients with type 1 diabetes with severe albuminuria continue to have high rates of kidney failure and death from cardiovascular causes. By targeting inflammation and fibrosis, central pathways in kidney injury, finerenone may slow kidney function decline, though confirmation is needed in patients with type 1 diabetes. The trial by Heerspink and co-authors represents an important step toward better treatments for kidney disease in patients with type 1 diabetes, particularly those with albuminuria. Immediate or deferred non-culprit lesion PCI in myocardial infarction by Robin Niefeld. From Radboud University Medical Center, Nijmegen, the Netherlands, and co-authors. Current guidelines recommend revascularization of non-culprit coronary artery lesions in patients who have ST segment elevation, myocardial infarction, STEMI, and multivessel disease. However, the preferred timing of treatment of non-culprit lesions in patients with STEMI remains uncertain. In this study, 1,146 patients with STEMI and at least one non-culprit lesion who had undergone successful primary PCI were randomly assigned to immediate PCI of non-culprit coronary artery lesions guided by instantaneous wave-free ratio, IFR, or deferred PCI guided by cardiac stress MRI within 6 weeks after randomization. Immediate IFR-guided PCI was not superior to deferred cardiac stress MRI-guided PCI of non-culprit coronary artery lesions with respect to death from any cause, recurrent myocardial infarction, or hospitalization for heart failure at 3 years. In an editorial, William Fearon from Stanford University, California, writes that the data by Niefeldt and co-authors suggest that in patients with STEMI and intermediate disease in non-culprit coronary artery lesions, a more deliberate approach with non-invasive assessment of ischemia results in a lower number of patients undergoing PCI than with IFR-guided evaluation, with similar outcomes. The non-culprit coronary artery stenosis in the patients enrolled in this trial appears to have been less severe than that in the patients in the earlier, previously published, COMPLETE trial, in which more than 99% of the non-culprit coronary lesions had more than 70% stenosis. It may be that more severe non-culprit lesions cannot be safely deferred because the chance for spontaneous myocardial infarction is more likely in severe lesions, especially if the fractional flow reserve is abnormal. Until we have more data, guidelines recommend that patients in hemodynamically stable condition with STEMI and severe non-culprit lesions should continue to undergo early angiography-guided complete revascularization, whereas those with less severe non-culprit lesions can undergo a more deliberate ischemia-guided approach. Zorevunersen in Children and Adolescents with Dravet Syndrome by Linda Lacks from the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago, and co-authors. Dravet syndrome is a rare but severe developmental and epileptic encephalopathy caused primarily by haploinsufficiency in SCN1A, a gene encoding NaV1.1 sodium channels. Risks of sudden unexpected death in epilepsy and cognitive deficits are higher among patients with this syndrome than in the general population with epilepsy. The effects of zorevunersen, an antisense oligonucleotide designed to upregulate NaV1.1, were evaluated in patients with Dravet syndrome in two phase 1-2A and extension studies. 81 patients 2 to 18 years of age with Dravet syndrome who were receiving standard anti-seizure medications received a single or multiple dose regimen of zorevunersen. Most treatment-related adverse events were mild or moderate, with the most common across both studies being elevated CSF protein levels as observed on routine laboratory screening. The data supported improvements in overall clinical status, quality of life, and adaptive behavior with continued treatment for up to 36 months in the extension studies. The safety profile and initial clinical improvement support the continued development of zorevunersen as a potential disease-modifying treatment for Dravet syndrome. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Gemma Carville from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago, and Heather Mefford from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, Memphis, Tennessee, write that many disorders due to haploinsufficiency are linked to genes that contain poison exons, which are naturally occurring, highly conserved alternative exons that contain a premature termination codon. The splice-switching antisense oligonucleotide approach used by Lacks and co-authors could therefore be more broadly applicable. In theory, the inverse strategy, involving the forced inclusion of a normally excised poison exon, could potentially be used to treat disorders caused by gain-of-function variants. In the meantime, the results of ongoing trials of zorevunersen in Dravet syndrome are eagerly awaited. Neoadjuvant GALP in resectable high-risk intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma by Guo Mishi from the Zhongshan Hospital, Shanghai, China, and co-authors. Intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is the second most common primary hepatic cancer, and the prognosis is dismal. More than 50% of patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma develop post-operative recurrence, and overall survival at 5 years is only 30% after curative resection. Neoadjuvant therapy is considered to be a promising strategy for the treatment of high-risk intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, but existing evidence has been limited. The GALP regimen, gemcitabine, oxaliplatin, lenvatinib, and an anti-program DEF1 antibody, has shown promising efficacy with a manageable safety profile in advanced intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and biliary tract cancer. In this Phase 2-3 trial, 178 patients with resectable high-risk intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma were randomly assigned to the neoadjuvant GALP group followed by curative resection, or the control group, curative resection and no neoadjuvant treatment. Neoadjuvant GALP led to significantly longer event-free survival than control therapy, with mainly low-grade adverse events among these patients. Effects of radiotherapy in normal tissue. A review article by Deborah Citrin from the National Cancer Institute, Bethesda, Maryland, and Robert Timmerman from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, Dallas. Radiotherapy is a key foundation of oncologic treatment that is used across the spectrum of cancer indications. Advances in imaging, treatment planning, and dose delivery have led to increasingly conformal and even ablative treatments, which have resulted in improved tumor control with no increase in the risk of side effects or with a decrease in risk as compared with previous treatments. These advances have facilitated the combined use of radiotherapy with efficacious systemic therapies, including targeted treatments and immunotherapies. Radiation-induced changes in normal tissue occur as a result of stem cell senescence, inflammation, vascular changes, fibroblast activation, and loss of parenchymal cells. Research into the biologic underpinnings of radiation-induced changes in normal tissue, biomarkers of side effects of various irradiation regimens, and new treatment methods offers great promise for further increasing the efficacy of radiotherapy and improving the side effect profile through personalized approaches. The eyes have it. A clinical problem-solving article by Salma Gayad and co-authors from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. A 47-year-old man was transported to the emergency department by emergency medical services after being found dyspneic in his car. He reported drinking alcohol for several hours and then having a sensation of tongue swelling, along with difficulty breathing. He was afebrile but diaphoretic, with hypoxemia and slurred speech. No tongue or facial edema was present. Fiber optic laryngoscopy showed limited vocal cord abduction without airway swelling. Neurologic examination revealed complete ophthalmoplegia with intact pupils and preserved limb strength. Brain imaging was normal. Over the next 48 hours, he developed progressive descending paralysis, areflexia, loss of pupillary and corneal reflexes, and respiratory failure requiring mechanical ventilation. Cerebrospinal fluid analysis was essentially normal. Electromyography showed absent motor responses with intact sensory potentials. Given the pattern of symmetric descending paralysis with prominent cranial nerve involvement and preserved sensation, botulism was suspected. The patient's mother, who first arrived at the hospital on the morning of hospital day 3, stated that the patient often ate perishable foods that had been left at room temperature for several days. Serum testing by mass spectrometry was positive for botulinum neurotoxin type A, confirming the diagnosis of foodborne botulism, likely related to the ingestion of improperly stored perishable food. Private equity's transformation of American medicine. Implications for health equity. A perspective on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare by Rakaya Yerby from Temple University, Philadelphia, and Marcella Alshon from Stanford University, California. Private equity firms have gained increasing control of U.S. healthcare infrastructure, and this growth threatens to undermine progress in health equity, defined as the state in which everyone has a fair and just opportunity to attain their highest level of health. Although private equity investors promise to eliminate inefficiencies, mounting evidence suggests that private equity investment in healthcare has generally resulted in curtailed access to affordable, high-quality care for rural populations, older people, low-income communities, and members of marginalized racial and ethnic groups. The proliferation of private equity has reduced access to care, increased costs, and compromised quality of care. Accounting practices such as sale-leaseback transactions and dividend recapitalization, along with operational restructuring, have led to shuttering of rural facilities, surprise billing, cost inflation, and lower expenditures on staff and maintenance. Although private equity has extended financing to under-resourced healthcare systems and generated profits for partners, it has done so at a steep price. The authors argue that states can mitigate these problems by monitoring the effects of private equity's operational and accounting practices and punishing entities that compromise access to affordable, high-quality care. From equity to efficiency, navigating changes to the AHEAD model, a perspective by Jose Figueroa and Ellen Mira from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston. In September 2023, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, announced the state's advancing all-payer health equity approaches and development, AHEAD model, which was intended to slow healthcare cost growth, improve population health, and advance health equity. 2 years later, under the second Trump administration, the CMS substantively revised the program and renamed it the Achieving Healthcare Efficiency Through Accountable Design model, indicating a shift in focus from equity to efficiency. The revised model no longer explicitly focuses on disparity reduction or targeted safety net investments and requires states to adopt policies promoting choice and competition. AHEAD remains one of CMS's boldest experiments in state-led reform, yet the revised model's limitations could have important effects. The removal of the equity plan requirement risks diluting state policymakers' focus on disparities, and abrupt changes in program goals and requirements may deter states from investing the political and financial capital necessary to achieve long-term success. Debt by design, navigating the hazards of medical credit cards. A perspective by Alexandra Alvarez from Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, and co-authors. Medical credit cards have emerged as a popular financing tool for patients seeking care they might otherwise be unable to afford. These credit cards are among the most common financing options provided by hospitals. Although they offer deferred interest, they may leave patients in debt and financial peril. When balances are not paid off during the promotional period, companies charge interest at rates as high as 40% and may apply rates retroactively. so that approximately one-third of patients with fair or poor credit incur high interest rates. Patients may misunderstand loan terms, may not appreciate the gravity of the decision to obtain a medical credit card, or may not know when they have been enrolled in a line of credit. Debt transferred to a credit card company becomes consumer debt and is included in credit reports. These authors warn of the potentially predatory nature of medical credit card companies and urge clinicians and policymakers to reduce reliance on these cards and their associated harms, including by strengthening financial assistance, enhancing disclosure, and ensuring that medical credit use does not ultimately increase the financial burden placed on patients. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a woman with asthma and obstructive sleep apnea presented with a one-month history of worsening dyspnea and dry cough. CT of the chest showed anterior bowing of the posterior wall of the intrathoracic trachea during expiration. Dynamic CT of the chest, a study of the airway during different phases of respiration, was performed, and a diagnosis of expiratory central airway collapse was made. This condition is characterized by pathologic collapse of the central airways during expiration, resulting in dynamic outflow obstruction. Expiratory central airway collapse is associated with common conditions such as asthma, obesity, and COPD. Thus, it is important to consider this diagnosis in patients with persistent respiratory symptoms despite treatment of known coexisting illnesses. In another image, a woman presented with a one-year history of a crawling sensation on her chin that caused her to scratch the area. An irregular ulcer was present on the right side of her chin, with reduced sensation around the mouth, lip, and chin. Findings from an MRI of the head led to a diagnosis of trigeminal trophic syndrome. Trigeminal trophic syndrome is a rare complication of trigeminal nerve injury that results in dysesthesia and self-induced skin ulceration in the associated trigeminal dermatome. Possible causes include iatrogenic nerve injury, stroke, or a brain mass. In this case, neurosarcoidosis was found to be the cause. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.